CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemon.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. And Burnaby is located on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Halkomelan and Squamish-speaking peoples. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Intravenous. I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Robin. How are you doing?
Bit of a stressful morning, I think, that we've just had with some technical issues in the studio, but it should all be fine, for the time being, at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but we've got sort of a mix and match today of some sound bites of a conference that people at the station attended towards the pursuit of justice in taking action on violence against women and gender-based violence at the end of November. And I think we're going to have a discussion based around sort of harassment and violence that can be seen on campus and universities, like post-secondary institutions, and the measures that can be put in place to kind of help and support those that are experiencing these things. But to start off with, I thought we could start with a song that I found off the playlist, and I've been meaning to play it actually for the past 2 weeks and just keep forgetting about it. But it's by a Vancouver indie pop artist called Kylie V, off of her latest album Crash Test Plane, and I really liked the song Lucky Streak, so I hope you guys enjoy it too.
I want to strike a match, I want to cut it off, I want to take it back, I wouldn't take you back. Now I'm in City Hall clock, and I'm lighting up like you left the light on. Did I fuck it up? Was it something special? It can never last, replaced with fire.
welcome back to Intravenous. That was the song Lucky Streak by Kylie V, who is a Vancouver artist. Now, we're going to be sort of listening to some sound bites from the conference that was attended. This was by the, well, hosted by the Battered Women's Support Services back at the end of November. And they were founded by a team of women back in 1979 in order to provide sort of education, advocacy, and support services for all women in the work towards the elimination of all violence. And they work specifically from a feminist perspective to provide a feminist voice against violence and oppression as an overall global feminist anti-violence movement. So very applicable to the 16 days.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And they really do fierce work. They are... I don't know how they're not burnt out, actually.
Honestly. Yeah.
We get quite a few press releases from the BWSS, you know, on the regular, and they're always informing and educating and rallying and, you know, putting things out there and really listening with an ear on the ground to the things that are happening in the homes and on the streets of our community in order to really make a difference in terms of safety for women in all aspects of our lives. And so...
Yeah, no, definitely. I think one thing when I was listening to the recording of the conference that I really took from it was their sense of holding people accountable for what they say they're going to do and whether they do it or not, which I think, I don't know if it's because I've been listening to a lot of stuff about it lately with the Hot Pink Paper campaign that I've been following, which is like its sole purpose is holding people accountable that make promises for improving equity with women, and holding those people to actually fulfill the promises that they make when they get elected in local government, federal government, whatever. I really took that from this in one of the sound bites. It's quite a heartfelt story of one of the panelists and how they helped a woman that was experiencing violence, and she says, and we're still having this conversation 30 years on.
Right.
And I'm like, that's so significant that it's 30 years on and it's the same conversation we're still having. Like, not how much is actually being changed. Specifically in this topic, I mean, we've spoken on the last couple of weeks of Intravenous when we've been talking about the 16 days of how there is actually a rise in violence against women and girls now. It's not that...
It's not diminishing.
It's not diminishing. It's rising.
Even after this conversation has been going on for 30 years.
Yeah, and more. It's not like it's static and staying the same. It's actually rising again, which I think it's so drastic. And I personally don't think it's being spoken about enough. I have been quite heavily into looking at the news because my open mics, I usually cover English news on it. And I'm not seeing anything about gender-based violence really at all in the headlines. And I think we have rising numbers of violence against women and girls globally, and yet it's not making the headlines. Why? Like, why is it not being spoken about if it's actually going up rather than even staying static or going down?
Mm-hmm. One of my thoughts about that, and I think this is something that we have talked about, is just the difficulty that it is for women who experience violence to come forward and feel vindicated and justified, or that you know, some justice is being done to the situation, because we clearly see in a bunch of accounts where you know, things take their own bloody time to go through a big process, and that process puts people through the ringer, and it's actually regurgitating the event in people's minds that you just don't want to have to revisit over and over and over. And the defending of your own character in order to prove someone else's guilt.
Yeah.
Is, you know, like it just makes it so much more complex isn't the word that I'm looking for. It just makes it such a barrier. You know, it's such an obstacle to be able to really believe in the system that is there for the process that we're forced to go through in order to get these things known in the public space. Mm-hmm. And so it's organizations like the BWSS, for instance, where, you know, they've made strides to try to figure out how can we make space and hold space for people to feel a level of safety to come forward about the issues that they're experiencing in all, like I said, in all aspects of the of their life. You know, they did a study a while ago about coming forward and not getting the kind of healthcare and social services that people need, you know? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's about believability and, you know, how we're taught to speak the language. And so sometimes we don't even have words for the things that happen to us. Mm. And if we don't have the right words, then people aren't hearing what we're saying without really taking time to listen. And that just complicates the situation a lot.
Yeah, I completely agree with when I was doing jury service earlier this year back in England, and we had a case that was to do with violence and abuse, and you're having to hear from the witnesses and the prosecutor, the victims of it, and to see what the prosecution and the defense question surrounding it, they have to be so willing to have their whole personality kind of stripped down piece by piece and analyzed, even if you wouldn't think it would be relevant to what they'd experienced. And as well, one thing that I wasn't expecting actually to see when I was in there was that, because the defendant has to sit through the whole trial and hear everything, that they actually had a kind of curtain drawn over, so they are just facing the judge and the jury and nothing else in court. So even just the strength to be in the same room as the person that committed the violence, even though they're not looking at it, like at them, and can't see them, but just knowing you're in the presence of them, and it was a historic case, so it was years on, and it's still, you see the effect years and years on that it had on these victims. So to be putting your trust in a system where, unfortunately, it hasn't probably got the greatest track record of, in these types of cases, actually having a conclusive result, I guess is the right way of saying it, it makes it, I think, that much harder to want to come forward, because you're putting trust in a system where it's notorious that these end up being kind of inconclusive and unsolved or don't really ever come to a conclusion.
Well, even the fact that you're saying that it's years later.
Yeah.
You know, that this has been drawn out over, what, 2 years, 5 years, yeah, 7 years, 20 years? Like, how many years?
Yeah, because it took years for them to even go to the police. And then I think from the police on, it was 10 years or something of like an ongoing police investigation, but also the pandemic did slow that one up as well, because the pandemic kind of happened slap bang in the middle of the police investigation. So that all obviously didn't help things.
No.
But it's still a ridiculous amount of time anyway.
Right. Yeah. And who wants to hold on to that stuff and revisit it that many years later, and you know,
revisit it, but also have it picked apart, have like micro examined on specific details. And it's like you have to go back and think about the specificities of such a tongue twister.
And it's kind of absurd to, you know, when we think about those things, because so much more is known about how trauma works in the brain and that it messes with the ways that our memories are formed. And so memory is not truth. Exactly.
Yeah.
It can be, and it might be, and it is, and it isn't, and it's a flavor of, and it's a shadow of, but it's a bunch of things that sort of come together and coalesce into what we sort of think is memory, but it's built on, you know, kind of this strange foundation of feelings and experiences and thoughts and you know, social structure and expectation, and you know, it's not exactly what I think you know, when I think of memories, it's like, oh, it's exact, it's true, it happened.
Yeah,
not exactly.
Yeah. And we go back to this concept that we keep going back to of your own person's truth and your own truth.
Yeah, totally.
Because everyone, you could be in the same room and event with someone, and you're going to have different recollections of what happened based through what you saw and what you felt and what you relate it to and how it resonates with you.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's memory of that event's going to be different.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very interesting, I think, that this isn't, like, you can understand why it's not being talked about enough in terms of the difficulty and the barriers that are in place, but also the fact that this isn't being spoken about during the 16 days is another thing that I've found quite interesting, because I would have thought if there was a time it would appear maybe slightly more in, like, news coverage or headlines or anything, it would be now. And even across social media, I haven't seen a lot over it. So, yeah, I just think that was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. But jumping into soundbite number one.
Yes.
This is kind of, it was more of the intro into what the conference was going to be speaking about. But I thought it was a really, it sounds wrong to say the word beautifully worded in this context, but I thought it was very beautifully worded, this introduction, sort of acknowledging the role that colonial history and its lasting impact has had on violence in Canada, specifically with the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and the need for comprehensive action. So here is soundbite one.
Let us be clear, MMIWG is an epidemic. It affects all at this table, in this room, and on the front lines. Aptly so, MMIWG has been described as Canada's ongoing genocide and Canada's dirty secret. It is essential to recognize that understanding violence against Indigenous women and girls is impossible without first acknowledging the troubling history as a colonial nation. Colonization has profoundly shaped the experiences of Indigenous women and girls, embedding ongoing injustices, hatred, racism, and gender discrimination from the moment of their birth. The legacy of subjugation includes cultural injustices, systemic inequities, lack of self-determination, and institutional apartheid. This ongoing legacy must be fully understood, for without it, the government will continue to overlook the urgent calls for accountability regarding the more than 5,000 Indigenous women and girls who have been murdered or who remain missing. We can only work towards meaningful change and justice by confronting this historical context. Indigenous women and girls have faced a long history of violence and marginalization, which is deeply rooted in the political, economic and social structures established since colonization. The systemic inequality has led to widespread victimization and trauma, creating a crisis that every Indigenous woman or girl is required to live with daily. The ongoing struggle for justice and equity highlights the urgent need for societal change and recognition of the unique challenges faced by Indigenous women. Addressing these issues is critical to breaking the cycle of violence and ensuring their rights and dignity are upheld. The Canadian government's ongoing neglect of this epidemic reflects a troubling disregard for the serious concerns raised by Indigenous communities. By dismissing these issues as insignificant, the government perpetuates coercive norms that further marginalize Indigenous women and girls. This indifference not only shapes public perception, but also condones the violence inflicted upon them. To effect meaningful change, the government needs to acknowledge this epidemic and take urgent, comprehensive action to address the systemic factors contributing to the violence and discrimination.
So that was the first soundbite, which was the introduction sort of into the conference that happened. I would love to know your thoughts on how that made you feel.
You know, there's a couple of things that brought to mind. One of them was this, it's not a billboard or even that much of a poster, but it's something that's glued to the telephone post at the bus stop where I catch the bus in the morning to come up. And a couple of weeks ago, it must have happened because I've seen it twice now, or, you know, a couple times. But this young Indigenous woman, 16 years old, was barred and barricaded by a man in some kind of a mart. Some kind of a quick mart.
Yeah.
And was screaming for help. The VPD weren't called or didn't respond to the call, apparently. And so there's a warning for Indigenous moms to tell their kids, don't go to this store.
Wow.
Don't go to this convenience store because this happened, right? And then years and years back when I was living in Winnipeg, there was an instance where there were a couple of sisters who were on the line with 911 and, pleading for someone to come and attend to the situation, and it had been deemed that it was sort of a false alarm because apparently they called a number of times and it was recurring, but one of them died, one of them was murdered, because they didn't take the call seriously. And, you know, I think that we can so easily allow for our own judgments about the ways that our lives are and that things can't possibly be XYZ or, you know, like, it's hard to allow information into our brains that just seems impossible in our realm of experience, you know, like being barred in a convenience store and, you know, some guy's knee on our chest when we're 16 years old, you know, like that never happened to me. So it's, thank goodness. So it's hard for me to imagine being in that store because it's in my neighborhood. I've been in that store, you know, and seeing how that works and just, But unless we start to, you know, actually believe the stories that people are saying, then, and really like incorporate them and take them in and integrate them into the reality of what is not only possible, but also happening in reality, then change is a long ways away.
Oh, definitely. And I think as well, it can be really hard hearing those stories when you haven't experienced something kind of even remotely similar to be able to understand it. And like you're saying, it's very hard to kind of incorporate it and allow it to kind of foster change when you can't relate to it very well. I know there's the big talk on sort of similar situations happening, but more on a racial level back home. And you saw it with the US and George Floyd, when you're having these situations arise, but also that the people that are meant to respond and be the safety, like, measures to assist you in those cases aren't living up to their role either. Like you're saying that the VPD didn't even really answer the call and didn't really take the call seriously. And there's so many cases like that where the police won't take the call seriously or not show up because they think, oh, it could just be some kids pulling a prank. Why would we waste resources going to that? But when it's actually happening, you end up having the worst outcome, which is obviously someone losing their life to it because it's not taken seriously. Or in the UK, we had a particularly famous case back in 2021 of the perpetrator actually being a police officer and using their role as a police officer to actually kidnap and kill a woman. And that has made it that much harder for women, particularly in the UK, to even want to go to the police.
Right.
Because it was a police officer that did it.
Right.
So it's like, why would we go and be vulnerable and try and get the justice that we deserve when you have members of the force that are directly impeding that justice? So yeah, I mean, that case, I that's one I will, I think, remember for the rest of my life, because it happened when I was about 17 and we studied it as it was ongoing, and I thought, really? A police officer? Like, how are we supposed to trust anybody?
Right. Yeah.
In this kind of like world where that can happen. But this next soundbite is talking about more in depth about the role that colonialism has had in violence against women and girls, particularly Indigenous women and girls, and talking about the national inquiry that happened into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
In 2016, in response to repeated demands and calls of action from Indigenous community leaders, community groups, and Indigenous women on the front lines, the Canadian government established the National Inquiry into MMIWG. In April 2019, the National Inquiry published its final report and presented it to the Canadian government. 231 recommendations were put forth in the report. According to the commissioners, there was centuries-long genocide that, based on gender, identity, and ethnicity, purposefully targeted Indigenous women and girls. The root causes of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls